I'm Rachelle Smith, and my voice is a weapon against wrongdoing, and so is yours. Join me as I expose the truth and stand up for those affected by military sexual trauma. We can break the silence together. Welcome to the Silence Voices of MST. Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode. We have changed the name of our podcast. You ready for this? The Silence Voices of MST. Not that different, still gets the same idea across and a little bit less clunky. So my guest today is Jeff. We met in a veteran entrepreneur cohort, and the mission that we're both trying to accomplish are very similar to each other. He has experienced some trauma in his life that he's going to share with us, and also what he's going to do with it. And at the end of the episode, if you want to leave a message to Jeff, you know what to do, and I will remind you again if this is your first time watching at the end of the episode. So stick around. Welcome to the Silence Voices of MST. Thank you so much for joining us. We've had a bit of an adventure today.
We have.
But yeah, again, thank you so much. And we're just going to get to it. So first question I usually ask anyone on the show is, what led you to joining the military?
Basically, it was childhood trauma. You know, childhood trauma can often lead to military trauma, and then you get re-traumatized in the military. But basically, I was a really good student. I was a straight-A student. I actually had an academic scholarship to college, and I played sports. I kind of used high school as my escape from my home life. But at my home life, my mom was mentally ill. You know, we don't know if it was exactly bipolar with schizophrenic features or psychotic features or psychoaffective disorder, but she was mentally ill, and it just got progressively worse. So eventually my dad left when I was in high school, and that left me and my younger brother with my mom, and my mom was pretty abusive. She wasn't, you know, monstrously abusive, but she wasn't really present. Like, she could barely take care of herself, let alone her children. And so even though I had an academic scholarship to college, I wanted to get out as soon as I could. So when I was 17, I talked to a recruiter. Mm-hmm. I'd actually taken every AP class that my school offered, so I had enough college credits to be a senior.
Oh, wow.
But when I talked to an ROTC recruiter and I talked to an enlisted recruiter, and they both said that if you enlist first, you get your first 2 years of ROTC waived. I enlisted to get out of my home situation. I joined young, actually. I joined when I was 17. Graduated high school early, so I missed my high school graduation. Enlisted just so I could get out, basically. Yeah. Get out of my home.
I understand that. That seems to be a common thread with a lot of our guests, is that the military represented a way out.
Right.
And it was a way out that was where you would have food, shelter, salary. You know, a lot of people, when they just are trying to get away from trauma, they end up in a lot worse situations, like homelessness or drug addiction or things like that. So it's pretty common to hear that. And was it anything in particular that drew you toward a particular branch, or it was just whichever one?
Well, it was kind of random in a sense, because my dad was in the Army Reserves, but he had left us when I was 15. So I was kind of inclined to do the Army, but I heard that life in the Air Force was easier, but they didn't really even return my calls. Like, so there was no recruiting for the Air Force at the time that I joined. I ended up joining the Guard because the Guard recruiter was the nicest to me.
Well, there you go.
He you know, drove me around to all my appointments. Like, he took me out to lunches and stuff. And I just got a sense that being in the Guard would be more of a family.
Mm.
And it was what I was looking for. My grandpa was a naval officer, but I was living in Utah at the time, and there were no real naval bases. So it was really, the only two branches I considered were Army and Air Force, and the Air Force wasn't responsive, and the Guard was very responsive. So I joined the Army Guard.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah.
Was the slogan back then, be all you can be, or
I think so, but the Guard, there was a different one for the reserves,
yeah.
But back then the Guard wasn't separate.
Mm-hmm.
like it is now. Now the Guard has its own seat at the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But back then, I guess the Guard slogan was just the Army slogan. But yeah. I think it was be all you can be.
Yeah. So what was it like when you did get in? Was there that sense of shock, or did you actually find that family you were looking for?
Well, I did 20 years, and at different points in my career, it was different. Like, basic training was kind of a relief for me, ironically, because as abusive as my drill instructors were, I knew they were doing it for a reason, and they were less abusive than my mom. So it was kind of, and I had three hots in a cot. After my dad left, I didn't have that. And so, ironically, like, basic training was kind of easier. And then I immediately went from basic training to ROTC, because that was the goal all along.
Right.
I had talked to, like, the ROTC recruiters. And so, you know, ROTC really wasn't that bad, because you're just doing tactical training while in college. You know, I was a college student. So that wasn't too bad. I actually graduated early, because I had all these AP credits. So I actually graduated and commissioned when I was 19.
Wow.
And then I got a scholarship to law school, and that's when things started to go bad, because my guard unit had told me that they wouldn't deploy me, and they put me in a non-deployable slot. And then one day I got a message on AKO, and it was my social, but somebody else's name. So I thought that they just screwed up the paperwork, and, you know, the guard had promised me that it wouldn't deploy me. I could have done the FLEP, funded legal education program. The guard told me, why don't you just stay in the guard, because you'll get promotion points, like, why get a break in service, or, you know, why do this and why do that, you'll get more training in the guard. So I stayed in the guard instead of going FLEP, and they had promised me to put me in a non-deployable unit. And then when I was in law school, I got this email, and it was a deployment roster, and I was on it, and it was to Afghanistan. And I was only 20 at that time. That was a shock. And then I deployed to I deployed to Afghanistan, and that's when things started to get really bad.
About what year was that?
2007.
Okay, gotcha. To your level of comfort, go ahead and take us through that deployment. I know it was something that really left an impact on your life.
Yeah, definitely. So it was with 1st Corps Artillery, and that wasn't the guard unit that I had been initially assigned, but it was still a guard unit. And there were people, there were attaches from the 19th or 9th Special Forces Group, you know, and different units. But the main element was 1st Corps Artillery. And they were good to me. I found that the guard is actually pretty good because, well, you spend less time together, but you're with each other for a lot longer duration of your life. So I have friends, even now, that I didn't even know that well back then, you know, this was 15 years ago, that I could still call today, you know. So the guard does kind of have that level of familiarity, whereas in the active duty, you're moving every 3 years. So the guard people that I was with, they were pretty good. Now, I was junior. Some of them didn't like me. Some of them did like me. It was hit and miss. But for the most part, it was like a family, you know. And in your family, sometimes you don't get along, but you're still a family.
Right.
But what happened was, as soon as we got to Afghanistan, they split us up. And it was very much not what we were told, because at that time, the guard was trying to earn a seat at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they wanted to pick a unit at the Corps level to prove themselves. And so they had told us that we were going to have command at the Corps level, and that we were going to be together in Afghanistan. Well, as soon as we got to Afghanistan, they split us up. So I got assigned to an active duty Army unit that I didn't know anybody. So it just kept getting worse and worse. What I did over there in Afghanistan, I was an embedded trainer. I was embedded in the ANA and lived on Camp Shirzai, which is an ANA base that's just outside of Kandahar.
Okay.
And that's when things started to get really rough.
They got dicey.
Yeah.
And ANA, for those who might not know, that's Afghan National Army,
that's correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. I just saw some stuff over there that was just harrowing. My first week there in Afghanistan, so we had a rule, basically, that everybody in Kandahar airfield, they had funerals on Sundays. And everybody on base would go to a funeral, even if it was with a foreign army. Because remember, at that time, there were a lot of foreign armies over there. Like, the Dutch were in Terrancoat. There were the Canadians. But we had a rule that if there was ever a funeral, everybody from every country would go. So there was a funeral every Sunday because somebody was dying every week, you know. And that got to me. But what really got to me was the ANA themselves. Because there's a joke about Man Love Thursday, about how before Sabbath, you know, they'll get whatever they have in their system out of their system. But within a couple of weeks of being in Afghanistan, you know, I witnessed junior ANA soldiers get gang raped by senior ANA.
Yeah.
You know, and that was right off the jump. It was pretty harrowing to see that. You know, I was only 20 years old. I had, like, mostly been a college student most of my life because I'd just been in ROTC. So I wasn't really prepared for that level of brutality.
Right.
That's kind of where my trauma started. It just kept getting worse and worse because we were basically told that we're not to interfere with their culture, that we're there to train them but not interfere with their culture. And so we weren't supposed to do anything about what was going on, you know. But there's a thin fence between the American side and the ANA side. So you saw everything that went on over there. I mean, you could physically see it with your own two eyes. So another significant event that happened was one of my friends was a JAG, and there was one victim who came to him specifically and said, you know, what happened to him. And this was extremely uncommon because usually the ANA juniors would just put up with it. You know, they just wouldn't say anything because that was part of their culture. Like, they just accepted the junior guy's just going to get raped on Thursday night.
On Thursdays.
So I had a friend that was a JAG. One of them came and talked to him, actually, which was a really brave thing to do, and said, look, you're Americans. This happened to me. Can't you do something about it? Oh. And so my friend who was a JAG, he actually started to do that. He started to prosecute the ANA who were responsible. But the ANA put a bounty on his head, you know. So he had a bounty on his head both from the Taliban and from the ANA. So he had to go hide. He had to basically go in hiding, and, like, he wasn't allowed to travel outside the American side of base and stuff like that. And then what happened is a couple of months in, maybe 2 or 3 months in, my best friend was killed in combat, and I believe he was murdered by the ANA in retaliation for what my other friend did. I don't know if I want to use their names, but he was in the Ruzgan province, and he was supposed to be on this mission with the ANA where they were going to go interdict an ambush. And there was, I guess it was a battalion-sized element of ANA against a company-sized element of Taliban, so it should have been a relatively easy fight. Well, him and his terp jumped over the fence, and none of the ANA went with him.
Oh my goodness! So,
in my opinion, they murdered him.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it was a setup. They knew it was going to happen. There were these guard guys coming in to shake things up, and so they murdered him. Yeah. I mean, they intentionally led him to his death, and, you know. And that happened just a few months into my deployment.
Wow.
You know, so that was kind of the environment that I was living in. You know, half of the ANA worked directly with the Taliban. The other half had ties to the Taliban. So there was nobody that was really clean.
It's impossible to feel any semblance of safe in exactly. That situation. Yeah.
Exactly, because they're just on the other side of the fence.
Right.
You know, I would like to talk a little bit about the history of Afghanistan because it's relevant to some of my other stories.
Absolutely.
So in Afghanistan, there's, for people that don't know, it's they kind of have an apartheid system, or you might call it that, where the Pashtun are the majority, mm-hmm. but the Tajiks are wealthier. The Tajiks are mostly from Herat, but they're wealthier than the Pashtun. And of course, after the Soviet war, the Northern Alliance resisted the Taliban. The Northern Alliance are composed of Tajik, Uzbek, and Hazara, mostly, you know, and they're in the north, in the Panjshir Valley. They were led by Ahmad Shah Massoud until he was assassinated. So how well you went, how well your life went as a embedded trainer, kind of depended on whether you were assigned to a Pashtun or a Tajik.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So my friend that was murdered was assigned to a Pashtun. So I believe he had ties to the Taliban, you know, because the Pashtun are heavily associated with. And I was just fortunate enough to have been assigned to a Tajik.
Yeah. Was there any kind of vetting process for how you got set with your interpreter?
With my counterpart in the ANA? No, not really. I mean, I think that it's complicated because the Northern Alliance resisted the Taliban, but the Northern Alliance were also in the minority. And so in order for the ANA to be successful, you had to have mostly Pashtun leaders. Otherwise, nobody would follow them. But the problem is that the Pashtun leaders were mostly linked to the Taliban. So there's no way to do it to where the leaders weren't linked to the Taliban in some sort of way. And so it was just a matter of, like, you'd sleep with one eye open and your hand on your 9mm.
So you're 20 years old and you're having these new experiences that I know you've just never even dreamed you would probably witness. What was going through your head at that point?
I mean, to be honest, I was terrified. It was kind of ironic because when I was actually involved in combat, and the combat was rare, I mean, so people don't understand, like, only about 3,000 Americans, and I don't have the exact figure, but only a few thousand Americans were killed in the entire 20 years we were over there. Combat was not actually that intense, but my fear was the ANA.
Right.
I feared the ANA more than I feared the Taliban, because when I was involved in any sort of battle, it was kind of like things just went calm, and I just followed the battle drills, and I just focused on that particular moment. Everything, all the past, present, the future, just boiled down to that one singular moment. For that moment, you didn't have any stress or anxiety or fear. Like, some people are like that. When I was in my most stressful situations, I was my calmest somehow, because you just focus on that one moment. But then you come back home and you're in your barracks and there's just a thin fence between you and the ANA, and you can hear the screams of, like, young boys being gang raped in the background, you know, and you realize that could be you. Right. I was the same age as the, you know, the kids that were being victimized.
Yeah. I'm also one of those people that calm down in trauma or traumatic situations, and I think based on your story as well is just that we're accustomed to it. So that would be our normal. So we know, okay, we just have to either stand still or follow whatever we've learned in the past that helped us survive and we'll get through it. And then we can be in shambles later.
Right, exactly. And then it's in the between times when your anxiety starts moving. Mm-hmm. So at the same time, I was assigned to an active duty unit and they didn't like me. And I don't know exactly why they didn't like me. I think it was mostly because I was a guard officer. But I also think part of it was because I was 20 years old, you know, and those NCOs had been in the Army for longer than I'd been alive.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, you know, and NCOs tend to not get along with junior officers anyway. But they disliked me in particular even more than the average officer. So they just did, like, hazing rituals, just, you know, nothing like severely traumatic, but, you know, if I would take a shower, they would take my clothes. And, you know, they would shave their pubic hair and leave it on my bed. Fraternity type stunts, right, just to mess with me. And out in the field, they're like, yes, sir, no, sir. But back at barracks, I had to watch my back for them too. So I was literally alone. There was nobody in the entire world that had my back, because my friend that was a JAG, he had to go into hiding because of the bounty on his head. My best friend was in the Special Forces. He was murdered by the ANA. And I'm here with these active duty guys that I don't trust. I would liken it kind of like a prison gang almost.
Yeah.
Because a lot of those guys were pretty rough. They were rougher than I was. You know, some of those guys probably, if they hadn't joined the military, you know, some of them came from rough circumstances. And in a sense, I had come from rough circumstances because of my parents, but not rough in the way they came from. And they were very cliquish, you know. So anybody that wasn't part of their clique, they, you know, they didn't really attack me. It's not a story of sexual assault or anything. But they would mess with me. It was like being hazed in a fraternity. And that's what really got to me is these A&A boys that are being abused, they're the same age as I am. You could see it happening. And then I'd come back, and these active duty guys that are supposed to protect me and supposed to be my friends, they're terrorizing me too at the same time. So I don't have anybody. So I started to feel very alone. And it was those between times, not when we were training or not during the battles, lying in the barracks, like waiting for somebody to come in. You know, I slept with one eye open and my hand on my 9mm, not because my 9 would stop anybody that was coming in, but to put so I could kill myself so I wouldn't be, you know, that's where my mentality started going. I just became accepting of my own death, because my friend who was in the special forces, he was killed. And they were killing American officers. American officers were being killed in combat, but they're also just being murdered by the ANA. So there was no safety. There was nowhere to go that was safe. So I started to become just absolutely convinced that I was going to die in Afghanistan.
And that's just no way to live. You're just in survival mode. You're not living then.
Right. So on one particular night, you know, on a Thursday evening, I heard, you know, it going on again, the ANA with the junior ANA, and I just couldn't stop hearing it. And then so I just became paranoid that they were going to come into my barracks and nobody was going to stop them. I didn't trust the active duty people that I was with. I didn't know them. I didn't have any confidence they would have my back if something happened. So I just became convinced of my own death. And then I started thinking, well, if I'm going to die out here anyway, I might as well control how it happens. And so then I took my 9mm in my hand, and, you know, I felt the hard steel. I didn't intend to kill myself at first. I just thought, let me put it into my hand and see how it feels. And if it feels right, then I'll do it. And if it doesn't feel right, I won't do it. So then I put it in my hand and it felt right. So then I put it into my mouth. And then I was like, well, I'm only going to pull the trigger if it feels right. And I just stood there for a little while, you know, 20, 30 seconds. And I guess when I thought about doing it, a sense of calm came over me. So I pulled the trigger, you know, click.
Wow.
But in my mental fog, I was so dumb that I forgot to load the magazine. So that's what it was like on that particular deployment over there. And a lot of people, when they attempt suicide, they feel relief afterwards. That's what I've heard. That's what psychologists have told me. And that's the way I felt. You know, I actually felt relieved that I was still here after I pulled the trigger and I came to my senses and I was still here. So I kind of made a pact with God, even though I wasn't religious, that I wouldn't do that ever again in my life if he'd just get me out of Afghanistan. I haven't felt suicidal ideation really since then, but I wasn't going to do it out of depression. I was doing it out of what I thought logic.
Right.
Because I was absolutely convinced that I was going to die over there. So if I was going to die over there, I didn't want to die over there and have the ANA desecrate my body. I would rather just do it and get it over with.
That's what people don't really understand when you are deeply traumatized and there's no relief from it. Like, that trauma keeps happening. Like, even if it isn't happening directly to you, you're still affected by all of the stuff around you. And A, you had no outlet. B, you were terrified of everybody.
Right.
And when your brain is in that survival mode for that long, it's overworked, it's tired, and all of a sudden the things that would typically make no sense to anyone, they seem like very logical, well-thought-out plans. So yeah. I completely understand where you're coming from on that. I'm just so sorry. When you go through basic or ROTC, even junior ROTC, I'm sure, they emphasize, oh, this is your family. This is, I've got your six. Like, you take care of the person on your left and your right. And they drill that into you from day one. And then when you actually get in a situation where you have to rely on others and you can't trust them, like,
right.
Yeah, it shatters you. And then, like, how do you recover from that?
Yeah, if I would have stuck with my guard unit, it really wouldn't have been as bad. But it was being stuck with a bunch of people that just, for whatever reason, just didn't like me. They were traumatized themselves. They were living on the same ANA base, so they were seeing the same stuff happen too. And so it just becomes normalized.
In making this pact with God, it sounds like it at least gave you something to attach to and hold on to and get through the deployment.
Yeah.
So with that, when your deployment ended, I'd say when you got back home, what was your mental state like?
I mean, it's terrible because I'd always been, my personality was completely different. You know, I was actually the class clown and the most likely to succeed in my high school because my home life was so bad that I used, like, school is basically just a playground.
Right.
So, you know, but I was a good student. School was easy for me. And undergrad was easy for me. You know, I got like almost a 4.0. I didn't quite get a 4.0 because a couple of classes I messed around. But, you know, all through high school, undergrad, and law school, I was, you know, pretty close to a 4.0 student. But when I got back from overseas, things were just different. People don't understand it. Psychologists maybe understand it intellectually. People that have gone through it understand it. Outsiders don't understand it. But I was just a different person. It's just hard. It was hard to focus on law school because I did go back eventually, and I did go to law school. I thought I was going to grow up and be a big lawyer at a big law firm, and that didn't happen for me, in part because of the trauma that I had in Afghanistan. Like, I didn't really talk to anybody about it. When I was over there, yeah, you know, you could say I had rank over the people who were harassing me, so I could have punished them. But the reality is nobody would have listened because the company commander and the battalion commander were active duty anyway. They would have protected their own guys. And I was separated from my guard friends, so I couldn't talk to them. You know, not really, at least. So I didn't have anybody to talk to over there. I just kind of dealt with it. Oh, I should tell you something else. Actually, the worst thing that happened over there, and I only bring it up because it's a really important part of my trauma, is they made a rule that you're not really supposed to mess with the dogs that are over there. Like, you're not supposed to play with the dogs that are over there because they're like wild dogs. But I love dogs, so I didn't find that to be true. Like, so there are dogs that I kind of relied on for friendship that I would feed and stuff like that. And Sufism, there's all these different, you know, we know about all the different sects of Islam. But Sufism is a sect that originated in Afghanistan. And Sufis respect dogs, and they actually look at dogs almost like spiritual. But in other sects of Islam, dogs are haram. So one day the Pashtun just took all the dogs in the city, in the village, just one by one.
Oh, wow.
Gunned them all down.
Yeah.
Just to mess with the Sufi. And I hid one dog in my Humvee. This dog was a friend of mine. So, you know, I saved one of them, but I wasn't able to save any of the other dogs.
Yeah.
So for me, that might seem something stupid to an outsider, but for me, that was the worst thing. Just the senseless brutality. Because it's one thing to be at war, but it's another thing to just gather a bunch of dogs into a village and just gun them down one by one.
Right. And those dogs were a source of comfort.
Right. So they were my friends.
Right.
So the only people that were, you know, would have been my friends over there would have been the dogs that I was hanging out with.
Right.
And they all got murdered except for the one that I hit in my Humvee. That dog belonged to a Tajik, actually. We were able to rescue hers, but out of all the dogs in the village, we only rescued one dog. So that traumatized me. So when I came back from being overseas, I was very traumatized. It was difficult to focus on school. That's when I first started to get psychiatric treatment, but it wasn't particularly effective. It was difficult to focus on school. I wasn't as good of a student as I used to do. I was terrified of roads because I was terrified I was going to be killed by an ID, which is another thing that I was afraid of over there. You know, these might seem irrational fears, but to me, they're rational fears.
Right.
The two things I was afraid of was being gang raped by the ANA, The second thing I was afraid of is being killed in an IED attack. So when I came home from being over there, I wasn't afraid of being sexually assaulted, but I was afraid of IEDs. So I was afraid to drive. I couldn't get it out of my head that I would probably be killed by an IED, even in the stateside. I mean, it was hard to perform in law school. And so I'd always been a great student, but in law school, I actually did pretty okay, circumstances considering, because I was enrolled in law school right after I got back from Afghanistan.
Oh, goodness.
We were there for a year at first, but then we got extended. But they would let me out to go to law school, but they only let me out like 2 weeks before law school started. So I had no decompression time.
Yeah.
So I went straight from out processing to law school. And I had no decompression time whatsoever. And in some ways, that was good because I didn't have enough time to focus on my trauma. But in other ways, I was still really messed up. So like I said, I was afraid to drive. I couldn't focus really that well on school. And I was extremely depressed at that time. Like, I had an apartment that didn't have any furniture in it. I slept on an air mattress like for my first 2 years of law school, because not because I didn't have the money, but because I was too depressed to get any furniture. But somehow, miraculously, I was still a decent student. I still had like a 3.5 GPA. The law firms at that time were only interviewing people with like a 3.6 or a 3.7 GPA. And so I just barely, narrowly missed getting into a big law firm. And I actually interviewed at a couple big law firms. And they told me any other year but this one, we would hire you. But the economy's bad. We're not hiring as many people. And so then, ironically, I went back into the military.
You chose it again.
I did 20 years. So I finished as a JAG. I started military intelligence. In Afghanistan, I did some public affairs work. I was a contracting officer. I did some acquisitions, some foreign military sales, and ended my career as a JAG. Mostly doing contracts as a contracts attorney. But I did 20 years.
And did that deployment, it stayed with you. How did you cope with that? I mean, joining the Army again, you were probably faced with deploying again.
Yeah, I deployed to Jordan. And ironically, that's how my career ended, is I got injured in Jordan. Actually, this is kind of a funny story about how God has a plan, if you believe it. I was starting to get tired, like, and I kept seeing civilian psychiatrist for it, and I went from being a 300 PT former to just gradually getting worse and worse. And it's kind of like in Brian's song with like Brian Piccolo, how he just kept getting tired and tired, and he didn't know why. And I went to civilian doctors, but they couldn't they just never came up with a diagnosis. Well, I deployed as a JAG to Jordan, and ironically is I survived my deployment in Afghanistan intact without any physical damage, you know, emotional damage and trauma, but no physical damage. But I got injured in Jordan, got sent to Walter Reed, and got diagnosed with a potentially terminal disease. But the irony is, if I wouldn't have gotten injured in Jordan, the civilian doctors never diagnosed me. The people that diagnosed me at Walter Reed, if I hadn't have gone to Walter Reed, if I hadn't have been injured, I'd probably be dead by now. So ironically, the Army saved my life.
Yeah. How do you wrestle with that, with those two conflicting ideas?
I don't know. It's just, it depends on how you want to perceive it. If you're religious, you'll say God has a plan for everything. If you're not, you'll just say it's fate. Maybe I just got lucky. But I ended up getting 70% of my base pay and 100% disability. So, you know, that's a pretty good pension.
Yeah.
And, you know, they paid for my law school, they paid for my undergrad, and I came out of it okay, all things considered. I mean, actually, the most traumatic thing happened after that, which is my brother committed suicide. You know, I think I told you about that. So it's kind of up and down psychologically. By the time I retired, I had kind of gotten over Afghanistan. You know, it's a little bit of compartmentalization, a little bit of just time heals all wounds, and a little bit of I was seeking psychiatric treatment, and I kind of got over it. But then when my brother committed suicide, you know, and he committed suicide like a little bit after I retired. The other just tragic thing is when a sibling or a family member commits suicide, the suicidality of the rest of the family increases. 3 months after my brother committed suicide, my cousin committed suicide too. So I had two family members close to me commit suicide within 3 months, and my grandma died within a 6 month period. So that was actually more traumatizing than even anything that I dealt with in the military.
Yeah, you're going through the transition back to civilian life and then significant losses. I hear you saying I got over it, but I'm sure when new traumas unearth, all of that stuff comes back as well. And what was your just body's reaction?
Oh, well, yeah, that's easy because yeah. I just started having just uncontrollable panic attacks. It could have ruined my career as an attorney because I couldn't practice law when I was in the mental state that I was in.
Right.
I mean, if you have a family member commit suicide, the people who have gone through it will understand it, but basically your life's over. Whatever life that you had, that's just over. That's just gone. From now on until the day that I die, it will always weigh heavily that my brother committed suicide. There's no respite from it. There's no escape from it. Afghanistan, at least there was some relief in the sense that I came back to the States, and once I processed my trauma, that never goes away, but things get better over time. When your brother commits suicide, there's just really no getting over it. I mean, that's your life. Like, for the rest of your life, you're someone whose brother committed suicide.
Right. There's just a branch off in your life's path where it just goes a separate way.
Yeah, it's just gone. Like, your former self is dead. Like, it's just funny looking back on who I was in high school, class clown. You know, I had an academic scholarship. I could have just did that. I just could have went to college. I could have went to an Ivy League school. But I joined the Army to get out of the trauma of my mom's mental illness. Turns out my mom and my brother are both mentally ill. I get re-traumatized in the Army, get out of the Army, and now my brother, you know, kills himself. So just, you know, you've talked about this a little bit offline about how just bad stuff just keeps kind of like bad luck kind of follows you. Like weird stuff happened to you. You know, it's like even today with the
right,
we were doing this podcast and the fire alarm went off.
Right. Like, and I don't know that it's weird things follow me, but it definitely seems as though there's not like a pattern or anything.
Right, it's random stuff.
It just happens. So
exactly.
And being the kind of person that stuff happens to when things are calm or you're relatively happy.
You have anxiety, right?
Yes.
Because you start, think something's bad is going to happen.
Exactly. You're like, when's the other shoe going to drop?
Right.
And when that shoe drops, it's not a ballet flat like I'm wearing. It's like a cowboy boot full of cement. And it just...
Yeah. So it's just like, I kind of feel like I have the Midas touch, but with death. Like,
right.
Wherever I go, people are just dying.
And you said that just multiple panic attacks a day was happening. And how did you try to cope with that or accommodate any of that?
Right, yeah. So people talk about, like, male machismo and, like, men are less likely to seek psychiatric care. But if you're having panic attacks like that, you feel like you're going to die. You know, you're right back in Afghanistan. And, like, even now, I don't talk about this a lot, but, like, I'm afraid of the night. I'm afraid to fall asleep. Like, during the day when I'm talking with you and, you know, I'm doing my job and stuff like that, it's not that bad, but I'm afraid of the night. There's just no way to express it. You just hear, you know, hear things.
It's understandable. I mean, significant things were happening around you. So these things were happening around you frequently, consistently, that you had no real protection from other than just taking yourself out of the picture.
Right.
So, yeah, something like that would stick with you for the rest of your life. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the worst at night.
Yeah.
I don't have the night terrors that I used to have. When my brother committed suicide, that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, and the panic attacks were uncontrollable. Like, at least with Afghanistan, it seemed like I had some control of my faculties. Like, I could compartmentalize. I could say that that's just stuff that happened over there, but it's not happening here. I could use insight to kind of reason my way out of it. But when my brother committed suicide, the panic attacks were so severe that I had no, there was no way I could practice law or even just live a normal life because I was having them so frequently and of such intensity that I just started thinking I was probably going to die of a heart attack. You know, and when you have a panic attack, you feel like you're having a heart attack.
Yes, absolutely.
But you also can probably, my theory is that if you have enough panic attacks, you can probably actually cause damage to your heart.
Yeah. I mean, it's racing and it's, even when you're trying to save yourself, like, I don't know, say you're being chased by a lion, like the way our bodies are put together is that your body's set to be in that panic mode for a short amount of time to get you to safety and that's it. But then when you're experiencing that I'm going to die feeling daily.
Right.
Yeah. No, your body's not built for that. Not at all.
Yeah. So I basically got hospitalized for a panic attack, not in the psych ward, but, you know, went to the hospital because I thought I was having a heart attack. And they discovered that my heart's actually, I'm actually in wonderful shape. You know,
that's good news. Right? Yeah.
my blood pressure is great. Like, I'm actually in great physical condition. I've always kept myself physically fit. So it's just kind of funny that, you know, I'm in pretty good physical condition, but I just feel like I'm having a heart attack all the time, you know?
So when you went to seek treatment or just figure out maybe what was triggering it, did you use VA benefits or did you keep going to civilian providers?
Yeah, I went to the VA. When I retired, and I medically retired, I had 20 years, but my medical retirement was going to be more. You know, I didn't object when I got medically retired. Like, part of it was an understanding that I would continue to seek psychiatric care through the VA. You know, this kind of tied to your disability rating if you have a rating for PTSD. And I had tried civilian providers, and to be honest, I know people complain about the VA, but the civilian providers were even worse. Like, I had a worse experience with the civilian providers, so the VA providers were very hit and miss. So over a course of, you know, 5 or 6 years, I had like 10 different providers.
Oof.
Right. Until I eventually found one that I liked, but she could only see me every 6 months because I guess that's how it works in the VA is the popular ones everybody wants to see, you know, it's hard to get in. And so she told me I could keep my normal appointment, but she couldn't see me any earlier than that because she was just book solid.
Wow.
And the option that she gave me is I could see somebody else within the VA network, but I didn't want to do that because I didn't want to go through my whole story again. So I just white-knuckled it. But in doing so, I had to get admitted. I went to the hospital, not a psychiatric test hospital, but I went into the emergency room thinking I was having a heart attack. And so that's... So the answer is I didn't really deal with it. I waited until she could see me, and then I saw her, and she treated me for anxiety disorder.
How long was it before you did get to see her?
6 months.
6 months of...
Just white-knuckling it every day.
Holding on for dear life, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Were you married at this time?
Yeah, or? I was married,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, how did that... How did your wife handle this? I mean, I'm sure this was very scary for both of you.
Yeah, not well. I mean, she didn't know what panic attacks were. She didn't know why I was behaving the way that I did. And she's a veteran herself, so she, you know, has PTSD. She has her own trauma. But basically, she's just frustrated, I think, because she didn't know how to deal with it. And I wasn't working at that time. And so it's just a big burden. I retired and I had a pretty good pension, so it wasn't like we were going to go bankrupt, but I am an attorney and I have the intellectual capacity to practice law, but I didn't have the emotional capacity. And so that's a hard thing for somebody to accept, is that the person that they love, I think, honestly, not to be offensive, but particularly women, I think it's hard for them to see. It definitely brings them down a peg in status when I'm an attorney who's intellectually capable of practicing law, and not only capable of practicing law, but being a great attorney, and I'm not because I don't have the emotional ability to work.
Mm-hmm. That brings up an interesting point because that is toxic masculinity at work. That
kind of, yeah.
You are injured. Like if you were physically injured and people could actually see it, then maybe it would have been easier to accept. But since you look okay,
right,
you should be able to provide or protect or whatever masculine role you fill in your relationship. And then when you're not able to do that, people don't know what to do other than judge.
Right. But, I mean, things got better. She stuck by my side the entire time.
That's incredible.
So she was very loyal. You know, a lot of military marriages end in divorce, but we're, you know, committed for time and eternity.
Yeah.
You know, we've been married for 11 years. Oh. So it's not like she ever, you know, considered divorce or anything like that. It's just, I think it bothered her. And maybe it bothered her because she loved me so much and she didn't want to see somebody, you know, suffer so much.
Yeah, I can definitely understand. And trying to explain to someone what being triggered is like, especially when you don't know what your triggers are, in your case, that must have been like you just didn't have the words.
Well, my triggers were everything.
Right.
Because I was having a panic attack.
Right.
Basically, like, constantly. I mean, there was no respite from it. There was no relief. It wasn't like I was normal 6 days a week, and then I had a panic attack one day a week. I was always on the verge of having a panic attack after my brother killed himself, because it's just, you know, I don't blame myself. A lot of people would blame, like, have a tendency to blame themselves. I don't really blame myself because I know how mentally ill he was, and I know the mental illness runs in my family. So I don't blame myself. And honestly, I wasn't even that surprised if you learned more about him and more about the situation. So I don't blame myself, but it's just like, am I entirely spotless? No, because I could have been a hell of a lot nicer to him. I could have taken him to SeaWorld one more time, or, you know, answered his calls, just been a better brother.
Also, there is, though, that, you know, you're doing the best you can every day, so it's,
I guess.
Yeah, but
I didn't really do the best I could. I could have been a brother. I could have been a brother. I know you're trying to make me feel better,
no,
but
I know a lot of grief is, and actually depression too, is that you're grieving the loss of a relationship or an identity. Like, you're grieving the loss of the life that you thought you were going to have, basically. So when you do lose somebody, you either, like, lionize them in your mind or angelicize them, I guess it would be the word, but, like, they become this perfect person, basically,
right,
that was not capable of doing any wrong. And so that blame does kind of shift, where you're like, oh, well, I could have done this and I could have done that. And I know personally with my own traumas, like, I felt that way many times. And the way that I got through it was just finally writing down the life that I thought I was going to have, and then also, like, writing to the person or situation that I lost, saying, these are all the things that I thought I would have time to say to you and, you know, never got to. And it's choking me up, but it helped put those feelings to rest of at least, maybe if you believe in heaven or, I don't know, going to the next dimension or however you want to call it. But even just saying those things out loud and not having them ping around in your brain anymore, like, they'll hear it. And it's easier to kind of put those weights down from your shoulder or your soul. And I always try to think of the people that I've lost as they definitely don't want us to be miserable, you know,
sure,
and they don't want us to blame ourselves. But it's, I mean, it's, you just have to take it day by day. So
yeah, I know. I mean, the one thing is, I took him to Disney World once because we had Disney World season passes, and he told me he would have rather went to Universal because he was kind of like that. He was he wasn't. I'm not gonna lionize him. He wasn't really a perfect person. I mean, he's mentally ill. He's not that nice. But I wish I would have took him to Universal.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand.
I mean, that's the one thing, you know. It's just, nothing I could have done would have saved his life, but I wish I could have took him to Universal Studios. It's such a stupid thing. You know, it's a small thing, but
I understand. And it's those little things that really keep us in grief is that one moment that we miss that we thought, like, oh, we'll always have time to do this, and then suddenly you don't.
So. Yeah, you always think you have time, and you never have enough time. Yeah. And that's kind of what I learned from all this is people, you know, people die. I never, when you're younger, you don't think people will die. You never think about it. You think you'll live forever. But the reality is people die. And, you know, you could take that either one of two ways. You could either become very nihilistic and very pessimistic, or you could, you know, have joie de vivre. And, and I try to go the second route. You know, I've changed a lot more in how much I appreciate life. I can honestly say, like, I'm doing a lot better now that I've gotten the proper treatment.
That's good.
And I actually did. I know a lot of the people on your podcast didn't very good treatment from the VA, but I can honestly say that my psychiatrist has really helped me a lot.
I'm glad to hear that. It's my hope is in these episodes not to, you know, completely write off the VA. And I should probably also throw out there that these are my views, not that of the VA, since I am an employee of them now. But I think what I want to accomplish with these episodes is people understanding that the care isn't the same across the board. Right. And that's something we really need to change.
It's definitely not, because I didn't know this before, but my psychiatrist, I talk to my psychologist about a lot of things, but, you know, they're all locally managed. Like, there's not one external VA. They're all, so my VA, Lake Nona Vieira, Orlando, I can say better than civilian care. The best care I've ever received in my life. When I was in D.C., that place was a shithole. And, you know, there was, like, crowded, homeless people, and maybe they weren't even homeless. Maybe they were the veterans, but maybe they were both. Maybe they're homeless veterans. I mean, it's, like, some of these VAs are rough. But I can honestly say the ones in our local area, Lake Nona, Orlando, Vieira, they're good.
Yeah.
I like the ones in our area. I like it, actually. I would rather go to the VA than go to a civilian doctor, at least within this network.
And that's something I would love to hear from every guest, you know? And I had an interview with Amanda. That was the very last interview of the first season. And she has had nothing but great experiences at hers. But then you listen to the episode right before that, and that's me and Maggie.
Yeah, you had a terrible experience.
So it's
very inconsistent.
It should not be that way, and my hope is that they figure that out, because it's there's lives in the balance, you know, and it's very important that people get that. I've read a lot of the pamphlets and memorize them now, so it's the veteran-centered, soonest, best care. So I want that to not be the thing that my particular hospital is well known for. I want that to be all hospitals are well known for that. So I really think that they have heard people's experiences, and they're trying, but any change does take a long time. It's never going to be an overnight thing, but this is one of those things you want to be an overnight thing, because lives are in the balance. But I am very glad to hear that you have a good relationship with your psychiatrist. What has come from you experiencing the pain of multiple traumas and PTSD and really facing a struggle and now being somewhat more stable and you have, like, a support network? How am I trying to frame this question?
What positive developments?
What have you learned from it? Like, how has this changed your life?
So now we get to the fun stuff.
The fun stuff. Okay.
Right. No, I think my life has actually changed a lot for the better. I really thought at one point in my life that I was going to be a stud, that I was going to be a big honcho, I was going to be a rainmaker at a big law firm, and I would drive a Porsche, and everybody would look up to me, and everybody would think I was the coolest guy in the world. And I was going to be like, you know, Alan Shore from Boston Legal or whatever. But you know, my paradigm is completely shifted. I don't care about money that much anymore. It's just valueless to me. You know, as long as I have somewhere to a roof over my head and my wife's okay, you know, I don't care that much about money. I appreciate a lot of things more that I overlooked. People have a tendency to just treat everything as if they're blasé. But, you know, we have Disney passes, and every time I go to Disney, it's like, in a sense, I'm almost like a kid again, because so much bad stuff has happened to me that it's like, when good stuff happens, I appreciate the good stuff so much more. And it's so much easier to appreciate the good stuff. I work for a company now as a senior contracts manager called Global Connections to Employment. And it's a contractor that uses the Ability One program to help disabled people, including combat disabled veterans, get employment. Wow. And so I feel really passionate about that, helping people like me, you know, combat disabled veterans. I have my own company that I started basically after my brother committed suicide. It's called Spartan Hope. It's an on-demand mental health platform for veterans where, you know, on one side of things, you have counselors and the other side, you have veterans. And it's intended to reduce the wait time. So I was waiting for 6 months to see somebody in the VA. Well, this connects people automatically. So if I'm a veteran in Florida looking for PTSD care, then I have a network of providers and they connect immediately.
Wow.
It's an app. I mean, there are competitors, but ours is a lot better. Our price point is lower. And also, it's the only true on-demand mental health platform where you can actually have a patient connect immediately with a psychiatrist. Because even, I don't want to name the competitors, I want to get sued, but even other, some of these other competitors that are online, it takes, I've went through them myself, and it still takes weeks.
Wow.
You know, because you have to give them your credit card information, and then they have to assign a counselor to you, and then the counselor calls you like 2 weeks later. So it's like 2 weeks later. With our platform, the veteran and the clinician can get hooked up immediately, potentially. And if not immediately, like very quickly, because what happens is the veteran signs up as a customer. There's a database of clinicians. They sign up looking for somebody for PTSD. The counselor basically picks it up and then calls them on Teams or Zoom, whatever they prefer. And it's telehealth that happens almost immediately. You know, my company is a good development that's come about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Wow. The need for that is so great.
Thank you.
Wow. Yeah. And you've launched already, correct?
Yeah, I've launched. You know, there's some complications because we're trying to balance the amount of clinicians we have with the amount of patients so that there's not a wait time.
Right.
And then, so we need to have enough clinicians, but then we don't want to have too many clinicians because then they're sitting around waiting. But, you know, there's just a lot of bugs that I'm working out, but we have launched. So anybody can go to SpartanHope.com or just Google Spartan Hope. And if they're in need, they can register as a patient and reach out and have somebody link up with them, you know, if not immediately, really quickly. We're mostly in the South. And there's rules, of course, like been only
per state.
Right. So we don't have clinicians in every state. It's mostly in the South. But if you live in Florida, Texas, Alabama, you know, the South, then we'll probably have a clinician that you can see right away or, you know, really quickly at least.
That's wonderful. And the name Spartan Hope, why did y'all choose that one?
Partially because I'm into Greek, ancient Greek history. Hey. And like it's kind of. There's Spartan races and stuff like that. There's a lot of people that have co-opted Spartan, but I also thought it was a good word choice, like a dichotomy, because Spartan, one definition of Spartan means thrifty or, you know, sparse or roughing it, and then hope. So it's kind of a contrast between like
hope is abundance.
Right. And so it's warriors having hope. You know, it's people that find themselves in Spartans. Circumstances eventually finding hope in and giving them hope, like, and it's something that I would have really liked.
Yeah,
when my brother killed himself, I really wish that there was a platform like this that I could have talked to somebody, you know, immediately instead of waiting 6 months. So that's kind of become my mission, those two things, working with GCE and helping combat disabled veterans get employment, and then my own company Spartan Hope. You know, just a couple other things. I like taking up yoga.
Yeah, yeah. And yoga is magical. Oh, my goodness.
Right. Well, when you're bending yourself into a pretzel, I do hot yoga, but when you bend yourself into a pretzel, you have to be focused on that singular moment.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no anxiety. There's no depression. There's no all this mental health stuff, at least in that particular moment, goes away.
It's just you and the sweat.
Exactly. And then since it's so brutal, 90 minutes of hot yoga, like you're pretty much too exhausted for the rest of the day to to think about your anxiety. Yeah, so no, I think that's kind of the ticket. Like, if I could do 90 minutes of hot yoga every morning, you know, my mental health problems would probably go away. It would go away.
I think I did that twice when I was stationed in Washington, and it was winter time. So when everybody came out of the class, we were all steaming. Yeah, it's really cool.
I mean, it's hard. It's brutal.
It is. It is. You have to bring like a gallon of water with you, or else.
Right. My teacher's a little bit strict. Like, you're only supposed to drink water during assigned drink water periods. So it's like, she was former military.
Oh.
And she trained with actual, like, some of the most respected yogi in the world.
Cool.
So, you know, it's just funny in Titusville how many.
Yeah.
Like, it's such a small town, but, like, it's full of retired astronauts and stuff like that. But she's actually, like, a really well-respected yoga teacher nationally.
That's awesome.
But she's also really rough. Like, she's, like some of her pupils, they're like, oh, just get into the pose however you feel like, and, you know, just do whatever you feel like today. Like, just do what you feel and remember to enjoy it. And then she's like, no, like, move your knee 3 inches to the left. Yeah. Like, don't look at me, you know, like, what are you looking at me for? You're supposed to be looking at your posture.
Oh my goodness.
Stuff like that.
I'm just having a mental image of Damon Wayans as Major Payne in a yoga studio.
I mean, she's like that. She's literally like a drill instructor. He's a yoga teacher, you know, but that's honestly, I can't say enough about actually getting psychiatric care, because if you're in the position where you need it, then you really need it. And there's, like I said, there's no machismo. There's no, I'm too masculine for this. Like, if you need it, then you really need it. And you'll go.
Right.
Like, if you have panic attacks, like I was having a panic attack, you'll go. Mm-hmm. There's no manning your way through it. So that's one thing. But the second thing is having a purpose. I think I have that at GCE and through my own company, Spartan Cut Hope. And then three is yoga. Like I said, doing something really intensely difficult physically helps you mentally.
Yeah, definitely. Because it's the focus, it's the mindfulness. And
right. It forces you to be mindful. You could be mindful even without yoga if you practice meditation, or maybe if you were just a really focused individual. But yoga forces you to be mindful. There's no other alternative options. Like, you have to be mindful in that particular moment. And so being mindful and becoming centered, even if it's just for an hour and a half a day, those are the three things that have helped me. Actually seeking psychiatric care, finding a purpose, and yoga.
So what would you say to maybe a young lawyer that's considering joining the Army or any of the services to be a JAG officer? What would you tell them to maybe not expect, but just to be aware of, to like protect themselves and like be aware of maybe hazing or things like that? What would you give to them as advice to make it through as a company grade officer, let's say?
Well, the thing of it is that my experience is kind of unique, because I was separated from my unit and I was stuck in the middle of Afghanistan as an embedded trainer. So I wouldn't expect a JAG to suffer the way that I suffered. And once I became a JAG, things were a lot different anyway. When I was a JAG, it was basically just being a lawyer but in uniform. I mean, well, that's what it is. And people don't realize the corporate nature of the Army and the Air Force too. Like, especially when you're in acquisitions like I was, and I was in contracting acquisitions, you're pretty much just a corporate attorney.
Yeah.
And so all of my trauma, I mean, my trauma is 15 years old. Like, all my trauma predates when I became a JAG.
Right.
So if honestly, I wouldn't have any consternation recommending somebody for the JAG Corps. The infantry, I probably wouldn't want my daughter to join the infantry, you know, or something like that. You know, I don't mean to be harsh against the infantry or any of the other branches, but there are a lot of rough people out there.
Yeah.
And if you can join and have an MOS or a branch that works for you, I say go for it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually have a lot of resentment towards the Army. And I know a lot of your other guests do, and that's fine. Whoever, you know, whatever trauma you have, that's the trauma you have. But I don't have any resentment towards the Army. I just say make very sure that you know what you're getting into. Make sure that you get a branch that you actually want to do. And I hate to say it, but stay clear of some of the rougher branches. Right. And then as far as being an attorney specifically, like, there's a lot of sexual assault. You know, if you're most, since I had acquisition experience previously, I went right into the JAG Corps into contracting and acquisitions. But most JAGs won't do that. Most JAGs are going to do court-martials. Court-martials, you're going to see a lot of sexual assault and a lot of same-gender sexual assault. Don't join the JAG Corps unless you are okay with dealing with SART cases all day long.
Right.
Because that's pretty much what it is. And there's still a lot of hazing. It's not the Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
You know.
Well.
Well, let's make that not a good example. It's not. You're not going to Disney World. You know what I mean? It's like the. Yeah. The Army is a rough place for rough people. I was prepared for my ROTC and all my training prepared me for the military side of things. I wasn't prepared for the fact that it was basically a prison gang.
Right.
It's very cliquish. And a lot of the people in are very rough men. And a lot of the people in are predators.
Yeah.
So I wasn't prepared for the social aspect of it. And I never would have thought that I myself would be a victim of hazing. The Army was the first time in my life where I was an outsider. Yeah. It was the first time in my life where people didn't like me for no other reason than I was a guard officer or mm-hmm. whatever they, you know, for no reason.
Yeah.
That I just wasn't part of the clique.
Right. You were not like them.
Right. And if you're not part of the clique, it's going to be really rough. And yes, the Army can breed camaraderie for some people, but it's still very cliquish. Mm-hmm. And if you're not part of the clique, you're going to be treated really poorly by rough people.
It's true. And you hear that in a lot of our previous episodes, is that when the victim came forward, they were immediately ostracized. And then that treatment began. And I still believe it's that way of, if you're the person to speak up, you're breaking the code. And it's just like, why can't you just fall in line with everybody else or like everybody else?
Well, already in the civilian world, women are not always believed with, you know, and it's a lot of he said, she said. Yeah. So, you know, you'll find re-victimization when women go through legal proceedings. And they teach you that as, you know, as a lawyer. I forgot to mention this, but I worked as a victim's right advocate. So they teach you this. And, of course, if you're a woman, you've already...
We just lived it.
You survived it.
You just lived life, and people just... For whatever reason, they either can't keep their hands to themselves, or their comments to themselves, or just, it's a lot, but...
But in the Army, you have the extra layer of, if you're not in the clique, mm-hmm. then you're nothing.
Yeah.
And sometimes women are in the clique, and sometimes they're not, but I think that even though more women have joined, it's still kind of a boys' club.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And people need to understand that. Mm-hmm. So I will add that caveat.
Yeah.
It's still kind of a men's club. Like, I hate to say it, but I probably would not want my niece, daughter, mm-hmm. sister to join the military because it's a boys' club.
Yeah. It's the weird thing to me was, growing up, I didn't really see that as an Air Force brat, but... My mom wouldn't let me do certain things. Like, even when I graduated high school, I wanted to work at, I think it was a Shopette on the other side of the base where, like, the Chili's was at Ramstein.
Right.
And it was, like, right by the dorms. And she didn't want me to work there. And she would just say, no, you can't do that. And
well, she was smarter than...
But, like, in doing so, in just saying no but not giving a reason, I did not have... any idea that there was any danger associated with this. So, like, when I was faced with similar situations in the future, I was like, oh, my mom wouldn't let me do this. I get to do it now. And, you know, so it's, I think that a big part of this problem is education, is people won't tell the whole story, or they feel that they can't.
Right.
And they're worried about a whole lot of things when it comes to coming forward. Like, am I still going to have a job? Am I going to ruin my career? Am I going to get a discharge that isn't honorable? That will screw me for life, you know? Well, there's a whole lot of factors.
I'll say, well, the one thing that the civilians understand, that it was perfectly clear when I was in Afghanistan. Camp Sherzai, that's an ANA base. It's a small base. Mm-hmm. There's an American side, and there's an ANA side. The American side is only half a dozen people. So what I'm saying is you can't leave.
Right.
You're not supposed to leave. You need clearance to leave to go on a convoy. You're not leaving. You're in prison. And, okay, Camp Sherzai and what I experienced in the ANA, that's one microcosm of the Army. But that same mentality exists everywhere in the mm-hmm. Army. You can't leave. There's no escape. Yes. So that's the difference between the civilian world. Mm-hmm. Is if you're a victim of MST or, you know, sexual assault in the civilian world, you could maybe avoid the perpetrator.
You could quit that job.
In the Army. Yeah, right. Move. Exactly. In the Army, you're stuck. And in some ways that builds unit cohesion with some people if you're in the club.
Yeah.
But if you're not in the club, you will be victimized and bullied and harassed and
repeatedly.
Know, yeah, like too. Like it's worse than high school. Mm-hmm. It's very much a clique. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on whether you find yourself in the right side of that clique or not. And being on the outs could just be because you're a guard officer, or it could be because you're a woman. So that's the risk in the military is. It's pretty good. It's not really that bad if you're in the in club, but mm-hmm. you don't want to be on the out club. Yeah. You don't want to be on the
that's
outs.
That's exactly it. I think one of our guests had mentioned that before, where that was you learn that mentality as soon as you get off the bus. Is they call you an individual. Like you don't want to.
Right. You
stick
don't want
out.
To be an individual.
You don't want to be the individual. So
right. And the DIs even say that. You're being an individual, mm-hmm. like that's the worst insult that you can.
Yeah. But that fosters that mentality of I can't come forward when something like this either happens to me or I witness it.
Right.
I don't want to be an individual. So it's a very nuanced problem. And my personal solution to this thing is that it's a cultural change. Like everybody in the Air Force knows don't walk on the grass.
Exactly.
We know it. Their children know it. Like their family members come to visit and they go on base. First thing they don't walk on the grass. Why is sexual assault not like that?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's a cultural thing. And at that level, it's a choice. You could instill that sort of that responsibility to one another in training, like from the get-go. Like yeah. You are responsible for grass, but like another human being.
Right. I think they're trying. They're trying. With the SARC stuff and, you know, but it's more pervasive than people think. And I learned that as not just a soldier myself, but even as a JAG. What I experienced as a JAG and what I saw as a JAG because, yes, I was in contracts and procurement, but I still did some court-martial cases. And I've, you know, read horrific stuff, mostly same gender. What I've seen, at least, was same gender. You know, it was lesbian women trying to pressure heterosexual women or males raping other men. So it's pretty pervasive, but it's also like, it's not even the MST itself. That's horrific, but that's kind of also a symptom, and the cause is that it's kind of like a prison gang.
It's the culture. Yeah,
yeah, it's a prison gang. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're Andy Dufresne in Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. You know, like, yeah. And if you either fit in or you don't. And if you're a mild-mannered banker or whatever, you know, I mean, just using the example, and you find yourself in Shawshank, it ain't going to go good for you.
Right.
And that you might find yourself on the outs for no other reason than you're a woman or that you're a guard officer. And there are a lot of predators. And so it's just like the predators are able to hide because they're in the in club. But not all branches are like that. Mm-mm. Like the JAG Corps is not really like that. I would feel comfortable recommending anybody, man or woman, to the JAG Corps. Certain branches, I don't want to criticize the branch because we need people of all types. Certain branches, I probably wouldn't recommend my sister joining.
Right. Well, let's circle back to your website and your app. How can people reach you?
Okay. Well, the best way is just to go to the website directly, www.spartanhope.com. And on there, you'll see some resources. We have some resources for just information, but mostly The main thing to do is, if you're interested in getting help, is to register as a patient, and that'll get you to our database. Depending on what state you're in and all that, we may be able to link you to somebody quickly. But if not, be patient. We're kind of in the mid stages of launches. We're already launched, but we're still working out some kinks. So that's the best way. If you want, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn too. I'm Jeff Fulmer, so I'm co-CEO of Spartan Hope. So if you look for any of those key searches, you can find me. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask. But the best way is probably just through our website, SpartanHope.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for putting up with a Rachel day, as I would call it, a Murphy day, right, where everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. But yes, thank you so much for just taking the time to be vulnerable with us and share these stories, because this is pretty much the only way we're really going to learn and actually affect change, is by hearing what is actually happening to people.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, there you have it, folks. That was Jeff. He has this awesome app again. It's called Spartan Hope. I'll have it in the show notes. And if you wanted to reach Jeff and leave him a message of encouragement or thanks, all you have to do is go to silencevoicesmst.com. You can click on his episode, and right beneath the player, between the previous and next button, you will see a send Jeff a message button. Click that. It will take you to the Salute to Survivors page, and you can go ahead and leave a little message. So thank you so much again. In our next episode, we will be speaking with Dr. Brandi Preston Rivers. She is a scholar, and I think she's absolutely brilliant. And she has done quite a bit of research into military sexual trauma, to the point where she did her thesis on it. So we'll see you next time. And as always, I encourage you to stay safe, be kind, and take care. Bye.
'Remember, our voices are weapons in the fight against MST. Stay connected, share your story, and join our fight to end military sexual trauma for good. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Silence Voices of MST.